Now I'm going to ask you what certain tools are. And so I'm going to show you some pictures of some tools. All of you know that I am interested in things old. What is this? It's pool stick sharpener. What is this? Now you can tell what the lower part is. But what's that wheel doing up there? And you know, why would you want to have that? I mean, can you imagine aiming that thing? What's this for? This was an important tool back in the early history of our country. I mean, an extremely important tool. Battles could be won or lost depending on whether this tool was used. Well, you see, gunpowder came in barrels. But any two barrels could have a different strength of gunpowder. And depending on how strong your gunpowder was, you needed to know how heavily you needed to load. And so what they would do is they would use this and they would fire it, and depending on how strong it is, it will determine how far the wheel turns, and then they would put a label on the barrel telling everyone what level of strength, which told them the percentage that they ought to go up or down from the normal amount of gunpowder in order that they could properly fire their pistols. What's the tool on the left or the one on the right? Either one, anyone have any suggestions? Well, on telephone poles, you know how they have those steel spikes that are driven in that you climb up on? The first telephone poles did not have that, so they needed a set of climbers that would strap onto one's shoes or boots in order to be able to climb up telephone poles. And that mean-looking thing on the right, that's to crush ice cubes. And what is this? I'll give you a hint. It was found at Gettysburg. And what does it look like it started out as? Bullet. What is this tool for? I'll give you a hint. Doctors used it. Ever hear of bite the bullet? Since they didn't have good ways of alleviating pain when they were going to saw off a leg, put the bullet in, and you can see that this tool was used quite a bit. They'd bite down there as they were going to be going through surgery. What's the point of this tool? The Gospel of John. Glad you asked. Good question. Very observant, class. Let's find out the purpose of John. We're not going to go to where you expect me to go. You think I'm going to go to John chapter 20. We're not going there. What we're going to do is we're going to approach this from a different standpoint, and what we need to do is have a New Testament introduction class, like that class that was pictured there at Rocky Mountain Seminary, in order to understand how to approach, how to use John's Gospel. John's Gospel, within its main body, is going to tell us how it ought to be used. So, first point is that if you want to date Jesus' life and death, you could not do so if you did not possess John's Gospel. John is absolutely essential for coming to the dating of his ministry. Now, we can see that in Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, John the Baptist's ministry occurred in the 15th year of Tiberius. Now, one could guess from this that Jesus' ministry began in AD 28 or 29, but that's about the closest that we come to as far as the start of his ministry. We don't have a statement as to how long his ministry lasted from the synoptics. But if we look at the synoptics, we can find, and John would concur, that Caiaphas was the high priest during the date of the cross, so that would be between 18 and 36. It was while Pilate was prefect, so it would be between 26 and 36. And it would be a year in which Passover fell on a Friday, which could be 27 or theoretically 30, or it could be 33, or it could be 36. So we could have the ministry beginning as early as 28 or 29 and ending as late as 36. But we would have no idea how long his ministry lasted. Well, let's see if we can narrow the chronology down at all. And I would like for you to turn to John's Gospel. And if you'd use the Living Water, that would be greatly appreciated. That's the version that we'll be utilizing. John 2:13, now the Judean Passover was near, so Jesus went up to Jerusalem. But if we drop down to verse 20, and for those of you who have Greek and are looking at your Greek text as well, or you can look down at the interlinear that I have at the bottom of the page, a corrected translation would be that this sanctuary has been built 46 years. It's often been treated as it's been in the process of being built for 46 years, but he is talking about the completion of the Naos. Notice the word translated sanctuary, Naos, refers to the holy place rather than to the entire temple. And Josephus gives us when the Naos, the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies and the holy place were built. Josephus in Antiquities, book 15, says that Herod began construction of the holy place of the temple in the 18th year of his reign. That would be 20 to 19 BC. And he says that the holy place was completed 18 months after starting. This would be 18 to 17 BC. Passover of the year 30 would be the point when people would say that the sanctuary was built 46 years earlier. I would agree with Harold Honer in dating John 2:20 in April of AD 30. Notice John is where we start coming down to specific dates on Jesus' ministry. Now, the next point, John 1:29 through 2:12 speaks of Jesus ministering before that first Passover. In other words, prior to John 2:13, Jesus was ministering. Honer dates this as the summer or autumn of AD 29. Now, context speaks of a delegation from Jerusalem interrogating John the Baptist in 19 through 28, right before John identifies Jesus as the Christ. The timing of such a delegation would likely be when crowds visiting John had been large for a period of time. In other words, if John only had five or six people following him, are you going to have a delegation come all the way out there to the east of the Jordan River in order to find out what this man is doing? They probably were coming after he had had a substantial size of ministry for a period of time, and they probably came when the crowds would be present. And I would doubt that massive crowds were braving the summer heat there, so I would agree with Honer in seeing Jesus' ministry beginning in the fall of AD 29. So we have the start of Jesus' ministry given to us in John, a very precise date, really. Whereas if we look at the synoptics, we do not have such precision. Page 3 of the notes. John also helps us to determine the length of Jesus' ministry, something that the synoptics do not. John is the only one who mentions specific feasts all the way through Jesus' ministry, which is a basis for dating it. We're going to find out a few moments later as to why John mentions all of these feasts. It fits very much within John's purpose of what John is seeking to do. So yes, we are heading somewhere, and the somewhere we are heading is what is John's purpose. John is using certain information that is consistent with his purpose. Notice in John 2:13 we have the first Passover of Jesus' ministry in 30. Then in chapter 5, verse 1, we have an unnamed feast, which is probably booths or tabernacles of 31. Well, in between there, we have a second Passover of his ministry that is not specifically mentioned. Then in John 6:4, there's a third Passover of his ministry. We have booths again in chapter 7. In chapter 10, we have dedication or Hanukkah. In December 32. That's a typo. And then John 13:1 would be the fourth Passover of his ministry. What we have here is a presentation of his first Passover as AD 30 and his last being in 33. And we need to be able to fit all of the events of Jesus' ministry that are mentioned in all four Gospels within the time period. So, all things considered, a 2-year gap between points 1 and 3 for the feast is reasonable, so it comes out to a 3.5-year ministry. Now, mentioning these feasts is very important for John's purpose. That relates to the geography of Jesus' ministry. Now let's make note of the geography of Jesus' ministry both in the Synoptics and John's Gospel. Jesus' public ministry began after his baptism and the temptation. Matthew starts Jesus' ministry in Matthew 4:12. Mark starts it in 1:14. Luke starts it in 4:14. And John starts it in chapter 1, verse 35. Now, let's skip ahead to the end of his ministry. During Jesus' last week before his crucifixion, he spent that entire week in the environs of Jerusalem, spending nights in Bethany, which is 2 miles away from Jerusalem, and then going to Jerusalem during the day. And so Matthew chapter 21 begins the last visit of Jesus to Jerusalem and Bethany. Mark 11 is where Mark starts at Luke 19, and John chapter 11 starting at verse 55. What we're going to look at is the period of time, how many verses in each of the books are between the start of Jesus' ministry and his arrival in Jerusalem for the last week of his ministry. Note at the bottom of the page the space between Matthew 4:12 and 20:34 is 606 verses. And if you go looking at that, you will find a grand total of Matthew recording 0 verses in that whole period of time of Jesus being in Jerusalem. 0. If you look at Mark, for the period of time between the start of Jesus' ministry and his arrival in Jerusalem for the last week of his ministry before his crucifixion, again, 0 verses in Jerusalem. Doesn't look like Matthew or Mark are very interested in the time that Jesus spends in Jerusalem, does it? Until the week before his crucifixion. Now look at Luke. We have 683 verses, and 5 of them are devoted to him being in Bethany. That's where he met Mary and Martha, and you remember how Martha was busy cooking. But in John, within that space, there are 499 verses. And 254 out of 499 verses, Jesus is in Jerusalem. That's 51% of that portion of the book. Do you think John is interested in Jesus being in Jerusalem? I think so. Jerusalem is going to relate very closely to the purpose of John. Now, why does John mention the feast? Remember, we made note of how we get the chronology of Jesus' ministry, and we find out that there's 3.5 years based on all the time notes of all of these feasts. Well, the feasts show that Jesus, who was a resident of Galilee, way up north, that he presented himself before the authorities who were entrusted by God to screen out false messiahs, and they were supposed to, but they didn't, welcome the true Messiah. Jesus did many signs publicly in Jerusalem so that people would either believe or defiantly reject him. The acid test of whether or not he passes as Messiah is, how did he pass the scrutiny of the religious leaders in Jerusalem? Can you imagine someone saying, oh, Jesus spent all of his time up in Galilee, and he convinced those Galileans that he's the Christ, and you're going to take that seriously? In order for Jesus to demonstrate that he is the Messiah, he has to pass the scrutiny of the religious leaders. John is looking at a very small sliver of Jesus' life. Jesus went down to Jerusalem for the 3 pilgrim feasts each year, and he probably spent about a week at a time. Meaning, probably, normally, he spent 3 weeks out of the year in Jerusalem, and on that little sliver of time, that's where John puts all of his focus. Even though most of the year, Jesus is elsewhere. Let's make sense of the chronology and geography in the Gospels. Jesus spent most of his time in Galilee. While there, he ministered to people in a variety of ways and trained his disciples. Matthew, Mark, and Luke focus until the week before his crucifixion on the ministry in Galilee. They also mention brief trips to Phoenicia, Decapolis, Samaria, Perea, and Judea, but mention no trip to Jerusalem itself, with Luke devoting 5 verses to Bethany, a suburb of Jerusalem. But John focuses very heavily. And you say, well, let's see if this is really that important. Page 5 of the notes, and let's start looking at John chapter 7. Jesus' half-brothers, in verses 3 through 5, urge him to go down to Judea because they say no one does in secret these signs if they want to be known publicly. Jesus does not argue against them, does he? But what he says is, my time is not yet opportune. He operates on the Father's timetable. So what did he do? He let his half-brothers go down to Jerusalem, and he followed secretly afterwards, as the context says. So in verse 10, you notice that he goes down secretly and he goes down later. Now, when his brothers had gone up, then he too went up to the festival, not publicly, but as it were in secret. At the middle of the feast, he makes himself known. which is what his brothers said they thought he ought to do. But notice in verse 14, after people had been arguing, is he going to continue to boycott the feast? Because Jesus had not been in Jerusalem for about a year prior to this. The John 6 mention of Passover was not a time when Jesus went, and John 7:1 indicates that Jesus had boycotted going to Jerusalem for a period of time. So at the middle of the feast, when the feast was already half over, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach, and the Judeans were astonished. Drop down to verse 21. He told about how he had healed the lame men back in John chapter 5, and they were all astonished. This was the last time before this that he had been in Jerusalem. And what was it that he did in Jerusalem when he was there? He did a sign. And what was the sign designed to do? To minister to the unbelievers, to cause them to believe in him as the Messiah. And what does he say in verse 21? I did one work, and you are all astonished. He's talking to an unbelieving group, and he says, you can't explain what it was that I did. You reject it as being from God, but you can't explain how I healed this man. Then in verse 31, we note that many people here have believed in Jesus because of his teaching and his signs. Many from the crowd, however, believed in him and said, when the Christ comes, he won't perform more miraculous signs than those which this man has done, will he? What is it that the signs are designed to prove? To unbelievers that he is the Messiah in whom they ought to believe. Notice that is what their response is here. Well, then in verses 40 to 43, a division arose with some saying that Jesus is the Christ and others saying that he is a deceiver. They have seen him do signs, and some are saying, that shows who he is. We need to believe in him. Others said, oh, no, he's deceiving everyone. Well, then the Sanhedrin sent out the temple police to arrest him, and they did not arrest him. And they said in verses 45 to 49 that they did not do so because no one ever spoke like he did, which caused the Pharisees to assert that the police were as deceived as the ignorant crowds, while claiming that no one in the Sanhedrin believed in him. But in verses 50 to 52, Nicodemus stopped them from lynching Jesus, urging a proper judicial inquiry to discover the truth, which caused others to call Nicodemus' name, saying, are you also a Galilean? Now notice, we don't have an overwhelming number of people among the leadership here believing in Jesus, but were any of them able to overpower him? Were any of them able to overturn what he said? Turn back with me just for a moment. Hold your place here, but go back to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. In John 1, we are told that there was an inability by those who were opposed to Jesus to overpower him. Look at verse 5 of John 1. And the light shines in the darkness, and yet the darkness did not grasp it. And when you look at the Greek of that, it's a word that has a couple of possible meanings, one of which is overpower, and the other is to comprehend. They did neither. They did not comprehend, and they did not overpower. The signs were designed to cause people to believe or to cause them to harden in their rejection. So let's drop down to verses 4 through 10 of John 8, which I believe is in the text, and we'll be talking about text issues this afternoon. Jesus did not judge the woman caught in adultery with the seeing of the eyes or the hearing of the ears. That's an important thing to make note of, because Isaiah says that one of the qualifications of the Messiah is that he will not judge with the seeing of the eyes or the hearing of the ears. In the interest of time, we'll postpone that discussion. In verse 12, Jesus, with the woman being in the midst of those that he had been teaching, he said that he is the light of the world, so that his followers do not walk in darkness, as those Pharisees who made charges that they could not back up. And as you remember, all of the people walked out when he told them, "Let you who are without sin be the first to cast a stone." Verses 24 and 30, many believed in him as he said such things as, "If you do not believe that I am, you will die in your sins." And these were people who had seen signs back in chapter 7, because this is still at the same feast. Jesus has done signs. And there were those that said the Christ wouldn't do more signs than this man would be. The same day, Jesus escaped those who sought to stone him, end of John 8, going more than a Sabbath day's journey down to the Pool of Siloam. This was a Sabbath, and as a result, the Pharisees didn't follow him, and he healed a man born blind. And then what was the outcome of the healing of this man? The man first initially identified Jesus as a prophet. Then he refused to label Jesus as a sinner under interrogation. And then he pointed out the irony that the Pharisees did not know where Jesus is from, since no one had ever healed one born blind. He said, imagine this, you don't know where he's from, and yet he's done what no one else has ever done. Look at this man arguing from the sign to these unbelievers that they need to believe in him. What is the purpose of the signs in this book? We look at the flow of this book, and this book is using the signs to bring people to believe in the life-giving messianic Son of God. Well, then Jesus, when he met up with the healed man, asked him if he believed in the Son of God. Son of God, that's a majority text reading, Son of Man in the critical text. And he did so when Jesus identified himself as the Son of God. He acknowledged that he believed. This man started out as an unbeliever. Jesus did the healing, and what was his response? He must be at least a prophet. Couldn't be a sinner. And he certainly is someone worthy of note, because no one has ever healed. And then Jesus said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" "Well, who is he that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said, "I, the one speaking to you, am he." And the man believed. Signs in the Gospel of John are designed to take people from unbelief and lack of life to believing and having life. Jesus then told, and he also explained, the parable of the Good Shepherd to those evil shepherds of Israel who had sought to destroy this healed blind man. Then in chapter 10, verses 22 and following, several months later, when Jesus returned to Jerusalem at Hanukkah, Judeans demanded for him to identify himself. He said that he had already identified himself as Israel's good shepherd, who is one with the Father. Jesus then asked which of his good works, a clear allusion to his signs, for which of his good works did they plan to stone him? And they said it was for blasphemy that he, a man, was attempting to become God. By the way, as we had the initial presentation this morning with regard to Jewish ministry, it is a common thing for Jews to say that Christianity is about man becoming God. Instead, it's about God becoming man. God becoming man and offering everlasting life based upon who he is as the messianic, life-giving messianic Son of God who died on a cross to pay the death penalty of sin. Well, then in verses 34 to 38, even under the assumption that he was a mere man, the blasphemy charge would be false because he shows that he and the Father are one. Then in chapter 11, verse 45, when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, many believed in him. What did the sign cause? It caused people who were unbelievers to believe in him. Well, then the Sanhedrin feared, chapter 11, verses 47 through 48, that if Jesus did more signs, everyone would believe in him, causing the Romans to take away their nation and their power. And then in 11:49 to 52, Caiaphas prophesied that it was expedient for Christ to die for the nation rather than for the whole nation to perish, without understanding the real meaning of his words. Well, then John summarizes, and for this I would like us to turn to John chapter 12, verses 37 to 42. John chapter 12, verses 37 through 42. But though he had performed so many miraculous signs in their presence, they did not believe in him. What were the signs designed to do? Doesn't this verse tell us? The signs were to bring unbelievers to the point of belief. And despite having done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. And you look at that and you say, zero believers. But John, if we work through his entire book, we find that John makes strong statements, and then he, a little bit later, softens the statement slightly. Drop down to verse 42. Verse 42 is the close of this paragraph, and it shows us that his initial statement in verse 37, although stated as though it were universal, it isn't quite universal. Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, so they would not be barred from the synagogue. Now let's think about this. The Sanhedrin, the ruling group of 72, which was comprised mainly of Sadducees, but there was a significant minority of Pharisees, with Nicodemus being one of the minority, contained many believers. By the end of Jesus' ministry, even there you could find plural believers. Many of them. A substantial number out of the 72. Not enough to carry any votes. It's kind of like Congress. A substantial minority, but not a big enough minority to carry votes. And guess what happens to all the votes? This bill passes by 2 votes. This one passes by 3 votes. We've seen this for the past several months, many months. And when you think of the ruling body, even among them where the opposition to Christ was the strongest, there were many believers. So what do you think there was within the populace? If there's a substantial minority of believers within the ruling class, there must have been many believers within the populace. Now, where did I start? Where did I start this message? Where did we start in the Gospel of John? We started with where Jesus' half-brother said, you need to go to Jerusalem. You need to show yourself openly, because if you do in secret your ministry, how much effect are you going to have? Jesus did not argue against their logic, did he? But he did argue against their timing. He needed to do this according to the Father's timing. And what happened? There was opposition that arose, and Jesus referred back to his healing of the lame man in John chapter 5 and said that he astonished them by that. And then in John chapter 7, we saw people saying, you know, the Messiah isn't going to do more works than this man, which means this man probably the Messiah. And then Jesus healed the blind man, and the blind man was able to effectively tell people, especially among the Pharisees, that it's ludicrous that they would continue to reject him. The sign, which by the way, none of them ultimately said, oh, there was no healing, this is a chill. They ultimately recognized that the man before them was the man who had been born blind. They couldn't explain how the miracle happened, and even though it's a messianic sign, they continued to reject him. Then Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and many came to believe in him. And yet Caiaphas and the religious leaders, there remained that solid, strong opposition by the majority within the Sanhedrin. And John summarizes saying that even among the rulers, though, there was a substantial minority that believed in him. I think John's purpose is clearly demonstrated to be evangelistic. There are people who are tempted right now to buy into Reformed arguments that say that John's purpose is to cause believers not to defect, and that that's why the signs were included. But pray tell, when we see signs, are the signs designed to, oh, Peter, don't stop believing! Didn't you see this sign? Is that how John is appealing in his argument? No way. These signs are designed to move people from unbelief and lacking life to having life because they have believed in the life-giving messianic Son of God. Let's look at the purpose statement. And I think that the Reformed interpretation of this passage is preposterous. Jesus, actually, verse 30 of John 20, performed many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you, the original readers, may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing this, you, the readers, the unbelieving readers, may have life in his name. Some people have looked back and they've said, well, wait a moment. Don't we have Thomas believing? Yes. Look at verse 29. Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And they say, doesn't that give evidence that this here is talking about belief of believers? No, it does not. No, it does not. That's a secondary thing that happened, where you have believers believing that Christ's crucifixion culminated in resurrection. But this purpose statement, if it were talking about the continuing belief of believers, shouldn't say, y'all, you guys. It should say, these things are written to reinforce us, the apostles, in believing and accomplishing the abundant life. But who is this book directed to? To readers. Readers other than the apostles. And how have the signs been used in the book? Have they been used to say, oh, believe, continue to believe this and you'll have the abundant life? Do we find that as John's message? Is that what the signs were there for? And yet, those who have adopted a Reformed interpretation have sought to say that this purpose statement tells us that signs were given to cause believers primarily were given to cause believers to be strengthened in their faith and not to abandon the faith. But if that's the case, it doesn't match the way the signs are used in the book. When you look at the book, the primary focus of the signs is to bring those who lack life because they have not believed in Jesus Christ as a life-giving Messiah to believe in Him and to have life in His name. Questions? Know what that tool is? Kind of funny pair of pliers, isn't it? When they would beat plowshares by hand, the blacksmith had to pick up a flat sheet of iron or steel that was red hot, and it was easier if it grabbed on both sides of that sheet. And then he would set it onto the anvil and pound it into the shape of a plow. When we look at the Gospel of John, this is not a discipleship manual. That's not what kind of a tool this is, although there is information that's beneficial to believers from a discipleship standpoint. This tool is designed to persuade a lost and dying world of Jesus' promise of everlasting life to all believers. Yes, there was a question in the back. Absolutely. Yeah, he's aiming at that. When we look at Martha's answer back to Jesus, the reason that she believed that he is the resurrector and the grantor of everlasting life to all believers is because he is the Christ, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. She says, of course I believe that you guarantee everlasting life because I know who you are. Absolutely. Well taken. Tim. Chapter 21 is essentially an epilogue, and the whole book, from one standpoint or another, is a reinforcement of who Jesus is as the Good Shepherd. Jesus had to overcome a huge misimpression that had developed among the 12. When he spoke of he was going away, he was going to be with the Father, the disciples kept, through the last discourse, opposing that. Essentially, it was like Jesus having, it would be like them saying to Jesus, you convinced us to come up here in your plane and to fly around with you. You can't put on your parachute and jump out of this plane and let us crash. And that's essentially the impressions they were developing. He said, I'm going to leave, I'm going to be with the Father, you're going to be here yourselves, but I won't leave you alone, I'll send another comforter. And they're saying, what in the world? For all intents and purposes, it looks like once people believe and have everlasting life, Jesus all of a sudden drops them off the back of the turnip truck. Now, how attractive would it be to a reader to think that Jesus essentially abandoned ship? But what he needed to do was he needed to successfully pass the baton in order that the message could get out and even that this book could be written, because it was written by those, that is John, out of the 11. Everything directly or indirectly ultimately contributes to the evangelistic thrust of the book. And in that section, Jesus demonstrates from looking back where the disciples have recognized, yes, indeed, this one has been resurrected who is crucified. He has a purpose for his disciples to carry on. But when we look back at the last discourse, what was it that he did there? He gave predictions that would be fulfilled in a very short order. One is going to betray me, and he identified which one. He identified things that would happen so that people were able to look and to say, yes, indeed, he is in charge, he is in control, and the things that are happening to him, his death, his resurrection, none of this is a surprise. They initially all flaked off, with the possible exception of John. But he has demonstrated himself to be the good shepherd. And in the process, has made it clear that he is not one that gives people everlasting life and then drops them off the back of the turnip truck and lets them suffer through and muddle around. But he is one who has an ultimate plan. If he's able to provide for the 11, that is an apologetic for those who would read. For example, when we look at John chapter 14, Jesus says, he speaks of going away, but preparing a place for them. Does not the unbelieving reader look and say, he doesn't drop people off the back of a turnip truck. He has a plan for their eternal life. It's a less direct argument than the argument of the signs. But I would argue that the passages that are often seen as primarily discipleship are secondarily discipleship. They are primarily demonstrating the picture into which Jesus, in his departure, still is making the same provisions that he promised while he was on earth. It shows that there is a continuity, and it shows that he's not dropping people off the back of a turnip truck.